Good morning, Council. I see that we have people coming in and going. You're settling into council table. Thank you for doing that. I appreciate it. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will ask the marshal to call the second matter on our oral argument calendar.
Second matter is number 823-1494. Jamie Alicia Messerly, respondent, versus Jonathan Warren Castillo, appellant.
And Council, I have just a few remarks before you start with your argument. And you may well be familiar with all of them, but I just want to make sure. So first of all, when you get to the podium, please know that it's adjustable and you should make yourself comfortable. Gather whatever materials you need, move it up and down, move the microphone. We want to be able to have a comfortable conversation with you. Secondly, before you start your remarks, if you would identify yourself as well as the client you represent. That way our audio recording will be clear and that audio recording of this argument is later made available on the court's website. And the last thing I'll ask you to do is keep your eye on the clock. It is specific, so 15 minutes per side, 5 minutes for the rebuttal on the part of the appellant if you choose. And our conversations tend to go quickly. We enjoy having them with you. So please go ahead, counsel for appellant, if you're ready.
So short. Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel. May it please the court. My name is Jacob Erickson. I represent the appellant, John Castillo, in this matter, who is asking this court to reverse the issuance of a harassment restraining order in this case, frankly punishing him for being where he was supposed to be when he was supposed to be there pursuant to a court order, and ratifying the behavior of respondent who was someplace she was not supposed to be and doing something that she was not supposed to do, something that she, in fact, indicated in her testimony. My client accused her of doing as a felony, and the district court said, yes, that's true, that's what you were doing.
But wasn't his remedy to go to court to enforce his parenting time order as opposed to calling her a terrible mother, clapping her hands and saying good parenting, I mean, holding the phone up to the car, forcing her to get a safety plan with the school. I mean, I could go on and on. I mean, wasn't that his remedy?
I think there's two things. First of all, while that behavior might be unpalatable, it's not...
That's generous.
It's illegal. it's not illegal and punishable. And second... No, I don't think his remedy is to go to the court. And the reason for that is he has an already enforceable court order for parenting time telling him where he's supposed to be and when he's supposed to be there. And going back to court, there isn't a good procedural method to do that. As his attorney, I can't go in and make a motion for contempt to say, hey, look, if we'd filed the motion end of December 2022,
well,
for example.
Well, why not?
Because it would be a criminal contempt, not a civil contempt. I can't bring a motion for contempt to punish somebody for past behavior.
No, you can get compensatory parenting time. Your client could have gotten that, and your client, so it could have been a civil contempt then until this parenting time is allowed by mother that...
It would not have been a civil contempt because we can't force Ms. Messerly to do something that she hasn't done that she still has the power to do. She can't go back to give it other time back. A compensatory parenting time motion could be brought and would be brought and is still pending in front of the family file. The issue there is there's this attitude, I think, with the district court of saying, look, instead of just following my order and doing what you're supposed to do, I want you to come back and get another order, which creates a problem for knowing then how to enforce orders. If I need to get a new order to say, hey, the prior order is in fact enforceable and you have to follow it, then where does it stop? Do I need to get another order?
But self-help is not the remedy, right? I mean, self-help is not the remedy.
But this, honestly, this isn't self-help. This is him going to do what he was ordered and allowed to do.
So let's take it from a different perspective. The district court discredited your client's testimony and credited Ms. Messerly's testimony. And in so doing, it also said that your client was not going to the school to exercise his parenting time, but was only going to the school for the purpose of harassing, intimidating, embarrassing Ms. Messerly. What do we do with that credibility determination? We usually defer to them.
You would defer on the factual matter, but under that Peterson case, we still have to apply those facts to the actual statute. In applying what was found to the statute, it's not sufficient for an HRO, and it would still be necessary to reverse the HRO in this matter. I draw attention to the Beach case saying that inappropriate and argumentative statements are not enough. Going there is not enough. Saying things that are rude and offensive is not enough. And forgive me because I think you're going to hate
this. Well, it is. But it is enough under the harassment restraining order if it's repetitive. And it, you know, its impact is such, you know, that it qualifies under the statute. It is enough. I'm sorry, but it is.
It isn't under that Peterson case because the initial behavior has to be objectively unreasonable. And we can say we don't like the behavior. It's offensive. It bothers us. We don't like that he went there instead of asking the court for help. We don't like that he went there instead of saying, hey, police officer, please enforce this.
What's objectively reasonable about yelling in front of the children?
That it's constitutionally protected speech. And I draw the court's attention to NRA, the matter of SLJ, a Minnesota Supreme Court case issued in 1978 February 17th. And I bring it up because it's about the nastiest thing I think I can say, which is in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court upheld Minnesotans' rights to say, fuck you, pig, directly to the face of a police officer. And it causes me alarm to say it. I'm certain that people's hair on the backs has stood up saying it here. But that case is offensive. That statement, as offensive as it was, and the Supreme Court goes through to say, this is rude. It's not acceptable behavior. It's not what this person should have done. It's not something that's appropriate in a civilized society. And then they turned and said, but it's protected free speech. It's not fighting words. And the disorderly conduct statute was narrowed, even though the text of it hasn't changed in the statute, to exclude fighting words. And that's what Dunham.
I mean, if we were just looking at language in a vacuum, that might be one thing. But we're also looking at behaviors, including following and filming and pressing the phone right up against the car every day, every Tuesday, I mean. And then there's also the incident where there was physical contact with one of the children that caused the children to scream. It's not where we're looking at these things in a vacuum. We're looking at all of them together.
And the district court did dismiss with regard to the children and chastise Ms. Meserly for putting the children into the HRO rather than addressing that in the custody case, which I think was another problem here, that this was done to deny my client his parenting time, which is also a fundamental liberty interest, through an HRO instead of going through the proper channels in the family file. But for some reason, Ms. Meserly's inappropriate conduct seems to be ratified with the issuance of this HRO, whereas my client's conduct, which is you didn't make the best choice, but it's still not illegal, is punished with the HRO. And that's an injustice that can't stand. That's a reason why the HRO needs to be reversed. And Dunham v. Rohr in 2006, the Court of Appeals did the same thing with a harassment restraining order statute that the Supreme Court did with SLJ by saying, look, this harassment restraining order statute isn't unconstitutional on its face, or it is, but it's going to survive as it is because we're saying you can only punish true threats, fighting words, and substantial invasions of privacy. And that's where that Beach case is important of saying merely inappropriate or argumentative statements is not enough. So the mere fact that he said, hey, what you're doing is a crime, you're taking my kids, you're abusing my kids by doing it, that's protected speech under our statutes and under our Constitution, and it's not grounds for a harassment restraining order, even though I'm certain that she was embarrassed by that. And the broader implications of allowing this HRO to stand are chilling on people. If people can't call out another citizen for committing a crime for fear of that person saying, I feel harassed because they keep saying I'm committing this crime that I am in fact committing it over and over again, victims should not be subject to harassment restraining order for attempting to vindicate their rights and report crimes against them, which is what's happened here. I don't think anyone comes to this court with facts that are particularly great. People are people. They make the decisions that they make over a long period of time. This is a case where, honestly, if there is a time where I think it would be appropriate for the court to review factual findings and find that they're not supported, it would be that finding that my client didn't exercise his parenting time, because Ms. Meserly herself testified to, I cut his time off in September of 2022. I would not allow him to see the kids at all. He did, I guess, keep trying to see kids, and he kept reaching out to me to talk to me, and he kept showing up, which of course made her mad. But I wasn't going to let the kids go with him no matter what. And that behavior is extremely serious. It's defined by our legislature as a felony. But even when reported and addressed, and even when the court itself said that, yes, that behavior is criminal, nothing's done about it. My client's punished for bringing it to everybody's attention. Under the analysis, my client's behavior might be offensive. It might be inappropriate. It is. It's rude to show up over and over. It's rude to go in some place where people don't like you. It's rude to say, hey, you're committing a crime. It's rude to go up to somebody's window and film it. But as identified in that case, you don't have that expectation of privacy. But it's not an objectively so far out of the pale of acceptable behavior when somebody is dealing with something as serious as having their fundamental liberty interest of their right to parenting time ripped away from them. And I think that his behavior, while not necessarily the best, was reserved in what some other people might do. If my client had gone and picked up both kids, thrown them over his shoulder, and thrown them in the car and drove off, I think that would have been much more unreasonable behavior, but arguably might still have been lawful under Troxell v. Grainville. So simply saying, why won't anyone help me? Why won't anyone help me get my kids? Why is the school helping her violate a court order? Why are you letting her come here early on my day? Why are you letting her take the children? What she's doing is wrong. When you look at that audio, he's just complaining to another person. That's not harassment. It doesn't meet the definition of harassment under our case law. It's an error of law that this court should review de novo, and the HRO should be reversed. And the court itself had identified that Ms. Messerly is not necessarily reasonably objective in her interpretation of things. On pages 79 onto 80 of the transcript, the court stated, I know Ms. Messerly tends to interpret things a little more extreme than maybe a normal person would, and I recognize that. This is a situation where I think we have the problem of that guttural reaction of this person is doing something that seems scary or that I don't like, or I don't like they're saying this, or I'm sick of this case because people are constantly fighting. And so the court went with a gut reaction of saying, I'm going to grant this HRO to throw a Band-Aid on it, and didn't look at the actual legal implications of what was going on there. And that's easy to do because emotionally we don't like it when people do things that are within their free expression. If you think about it, the right to free speech is really the right to be offensive, because if you're not being offensive, then no one's gonna complain about it. So my client's conduct is not objectionably unreasonable because it's within the realm of protected speech. The things that he was saying were correct. I think it's a grave injustice that she's doing something that's far more criminal and has no apparent liability for that, and in effect, gets it ratified by having this HRO awarded on her behalf, which for a time cut my client completely off from his right to parenting time in violation of the family statutes that require you to have a hearing before that can be done. Unfortunately, the truly bizarre procedural history of this case, where it started in Carver County, had a hearing, was set on for another judge. The judge said, I don't think I should hear this. I think it should go with the family file. And then the delay in having that happen has made it hard to really address all of those issues, because the challenges to the HRO on that were raised in the family file that I believe that this would be combined with. I'm sorry, that was a very long answer. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you. We have no questions for you, counsel.
Okay.
You do have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask the court to reverse the district court and dismiss the HRO, because applying the law to the facts found by the district court, it's not sufficient. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And respondent, we're ready for you.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Jason Brown. I represent the respondent in this case, Jamie Messerly. We're asking this court to affirm the district court's entry of a harassment restraining order against Mr. Castillo. I know through your questions that the court is familiar with the underlying facts, and so I'll focus on two arguments today. The first is kind of walking the court through the harassment statute and explaining why each facet of that statute was satisfied during the hearing in this case, and along the way address the arguments made by my colleague. With regard to a harassment restraining order, I know this court is used to seeing a lot of appeals relating to the relevant statute. 609.748 subdivision 1A1 defines harassment as a series of repeated incidents of intrusive, unwanted acts, words, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another. And Your Honors, that is exactly what we have going on here.
What did he do that was unsafe? I mean, this was all in a public place. There were other people around. He never touched her, as far as I can tell from the record, or at least the trial transcript. I mean, it was annoying, and it was probably inappropriate, but what about it was unsafe?
From the perspective of Ms. Meserly, these parties were in a cohabitant relationship for 7 years. And during the course of that relationship, there were certain experiences that she had. And as a result of their separating, there was a trial in Hennepin County concerning the custody of their two elementary age children. And the court in that case awarded my client sole legal custody as well as sole physical custody. Now, the court could take judicial notice of the entry of the decree in that custody case, but what I will tell the court to explain why safety is a concern is that the record was very clear in that underlying case that my client was a victim of significant physical and emotional abuse during their relationship, including scenarios where she was locked out of her own home barefoot in the winter because Mr. Castillo decided that she wasn't fit enough to be in their residence at the time. That's just one example. And so the court, knowing that backstory and understanding where my client is coming from, she's been portrayed by my colleague as somewhat frail and somewhat sensitive. That's why. That's why she's sensitive and frail with regard to Mr. Castillo, because of that relational experience. And more to the point, Your Honors, Mr. Castillo knows darn well that that is the nature of their relationship.
I mean, I appreciate the backstory, counsel. It's helpful from my perspective, but it's difficult on review, on our review, to account for that when it's not in our record. None of that is in our record on appeal. And there's not testimony indicating why she was fearful based on the conduct that is at issue here. So focusing on the conduct that is at issue here, mm-hmm. that is described in the testimony in this proceeding that we can review on appeal, help me understand what the safety concern is.
Sure. The safety concerns are as follows. I mean, we've got the words that have been uttered. We also have the acts, the repeated acts that have been described and were testified about. The act of following my client into that school, the act of following her out of that school, the act of changing the time that he would drive to the school to comport with the time that she would arrive at the school when she was trying to avoid him. Incidents of him detecting that she was leaving from a different door than she might normally leave, and him finding out where that door was and using that door instead of another door. And so, again, without getting into the details about their history, the fact is that that caused her a sense of fear for her safety. She was simply trying to walk into a school and walk out of a school, and she was intercepted at four different points on some occasions, and that caused her fear. With regard to repeated incidents, I just mentioned, we've got nearly 3 months of an individual showing up to a small private Catholic school, elementary age students, every Tuesday for the months of January, February, and March of 2023.
Now, he did have a legitimate purpose in being there at that time.
He may have had a legitimate purpose in his mind, but the argument is that...
And according to a court order, he had a legitimate purpose in being there.
He did. And I'm not here to suggest that he wasn't legally or appropriately at the school. The question, I think, before the district court and before this court is not, are you legally entitled to be somewhere? It's what conduct have you engaged in while you are legally present at that location? We've cited for the court in our responsive brief four different scenarios in which this court has found a harassment restraining order to be valid, all of which are unpublished, when someone was legally at an appropriate spot, be it a bar, be it a school, be it sending a package, be it making phone calls, things of that sort. So the question is not whether he could have been there. We're not arguing he couldn't have been there. The argument is, what did he do once he was there? And the stuff that he did while he was there was all of the things that you've heard about, the intrusive words, acts, gestures, statements to my client in front of others about what a horrible mother she is, statements about the fact that she has kidnapped the party's children, statements made about her engaging in illegal activity, that she's abusing the children, not just doing that to her alone, and not just doing it in front of staff, but doing it, for example, in front of a table where there were other adults and another child present trying to sell their Girl Scout cookies. And him approaching and saying, hey, she's been withholding my time for the last 6 months. Telling the child herself, what your mother is doing is abuse, you know. Informing mother in front of this Girl Scout table, you've been violating my pickup time and you are violating a court order. You don't have the authority to do this.
And all of those statements are actually true.
Those statements are true, but again, it's the manner and it's the individual that they are being uttered in front of that raises a privacy concern.
I mean, I think that counsel's argument is that it is fundamentally unfair to essentially punish him because he's just trying to exercise his parenting time, or that he's there to exercise his parenting time and she's not allowing him to do that and is doing it in an illegal way. And so why is it that an HRO is appropriate under those circumstances?
I think because, as the court pointed out when my colleague was addressing his position, you don't simply take matters into your own hands. You don't simply show up and ask a Girl Scout or a school principal or a child or others to adjudicate a criminal act or an alleged criminal act or some alleged wrongdoing under a family court order. That is not reasonable. My colleague said that his client is being punished because he's brought this to everyone's attention. But the fact is that at the time, he hadn't brought it to everyone's attention. The major oversight is that he hadn't brought it to the family court's attention. And as your honors pointed out, that's the remedy. You can file for contempt. You can report this to law enforcement. You can seek compensatory parenting time. You can seek to modify parenting time. You can seek a motion to enforce. You can pick up the phone and call counsel and try to have a conversation about the matter. That didn't happen until the latter part of February. And I was the one who initiated that contact to try to put this to a stop, and that's in the record. Those are what reasonable, behaviorally appropriate individuals do. They don't torment, they don't follow, they don't video record. And, Your Honors, it's not as though any single incident that Mr. Castillo engaged in might provide some basis for a harassment restraining order. That's why the statute requires repeated acts. I could see if he showed up at the school once and he was upset. I could maybe see twice, maybe a third time. But we're talking about 10, 11, 12 times. We're talking about him sitting in his vehicle, watching my client exit her vehicle, following her in, taunting her while she's walking in. Taunting her while she's in the school, telling others about their very private personal business, making a scene, and then following her back to her car and antagonizing her once again and video recording her and watching her drive off. And wash, rinse, and repeat the next Tuesday. The cumulative effect of the acts that Mr. Castillo engaged in, they are clearly harassment. And the court in this case made a very specific finding that that was his intent. That's the function of the district court, is to assess witness credibility, to determine whether or not someone is or is not engaging in an intent to do something and whether their conduct was reasonable. And in this case, the district court found that it was not reasonable. He was not there to exchange the girls. He wasn't. He was there to get to her, to get to Ms. Messerly, as he knew he could. With regard to the arguments that my colleague has made regarding privacy concerns, the Dunham case points out, and I'm quoting now, the government interest in protecting individuals against repeated and substantial intrusions of privacy far outweighs any incident expression of personal opinion. This is not an incident expression of personal opinion. These were a series of repeated acts accusing my client of doing something. With regard to the claim that this is somehow protected speech, Mr. Castillo and his counsel cite a statute I've not seen before. It's because I'm usually a family law lawyer, but today I get to work in government. Minnesota Statute 554.03. There's a statute that says that lawful conduct or speech that is genuinely aimed in whole or part at procuring favorable government action is immune from liability, unless the conduct or speech constitutes a tort or a violation of a person's constitutional rights. Okay. So they're relying on the statute and saying, well, look, it's free speech. I can say what I want. I'm trying to get the government to help me. I need the police to help me. I need someone to call law enforcement. I need someone to arrest her. I need someone to charge her. Notwithstanding the fact that he tried doing that, according to his own testimony, for months prior to starting to show up at the school and take the situation into his own hands. But here's the more important point. That same series of statutes, 554.01 subdivision 6, it defines public participation as speech or lawful conduct genuinely aimed in whole or part at procuring favorable government action, including but not limited to, and this is important, seeking assistance from or reporting suspected unlawful conduct to law enforcement. He was not reporting inappropriate or otherwise alleged illegal conduct to law enforcement. He was reporting it to a Girl Scout mother selling cookies. That cannot possibly be the intent of the legislature in creating that particular statute. With regard to this question about privacy, they cite this Peterson decision, which talks about a scenario where a man observes the lack of a car seat in mother's vehicle. And then he reports that lack of a car seat from a distance of 4 feet. He's away looking and he sees no car seat. He reports that, law enforcement follows up, and there's fallout and she files for a harassment restraining order. There was a claim made that in that case that was not a violation of mom's privacy because no one has a Fourth Amendment constitutional right to privacy if they're in the public arena in their motor vehicle. But here's what the Peterson court went on to say. It is conceivable the cumulative effect of persistent, baseless attempts to peer inside a person's vehicle might rise to the level of a substantial adverse effect on safety, security, or privacy. And that's what we have here. He wasn't merely a passive observer. He didn't just happen to stroll by Ms. Messerly's vehicle. He was there knocking, and he had his camera out, and he did it repeatedly. And it lands exactly within the purview of what the court had to say in that case. I see my time is expiring. We do ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. We have a lot to get through and little time to do it. I want to start with addressing Your Honor's question about the safety issue. The reason that respondent has so much difficulty answering that question is there isn't one. There isn't a safety challenge. There's nothing about this that indicates in her behavior that she feared for her safety. She kept going back and doing it over and over again. You don't go someplace that you feel unsafe over and over again.
Well, she had to pick up the children.
She had to not pick up the children.
Well,
the court order was to not do that.
Is it possible for the district court to infer that there was a safety issue from the fact that the school had to develop a safety plan and then there was another incident where another parent had to assist her and the children in getting into the car? I mean, those together, I think, might create a reasonable inference that there is some safety issue associated with his behavior.
I think the issue there is that we don't actually have the safety plan. She went in saying, I have full physical and full legal custody and I'm taking the kids and I terminated his parenting time without any lawful order to do that. And the school, unwilling to get in the way, followed the mother with full physical and legal custody. And for all the complaints that respondent raises, and Mr. Brown is an excellent attorney, about behavior that happened in the past, based on that, the court still gave my client parenting time, gave him this parenting time, and still decided after all that happened that he should go get his parenting time by starting it by picking up the kids at the school. So the court didn't see a safety concern based on all the prior history. And we don't...
Maybe not for the children, but for her.
It's, well, still ordered him to go there and do that. That's still his ordered parenting time for pickup. And if he's not supposed to pick the kids up there because she's not supposed to be there and she takes the kids, then where is he supposed to go to get the kids? Because he necessarily would have to have contact with her, which is why the school was supposed to be the choice. She fought tooth and nail against letting him pick the kids up there, and the court referenced that in the transcript, that it was aware that that was something that she objected to, and the court, over her objection, said, no, you get to go to the school, and did it. She self-helped. She decided that I don't like the court's order. I'm just going to go to the school, take the kids so he can't do what I don't want him to do. This is not a situation where she was simply trying to walk in and out of the school without any issue. She was trying to go into the school to commit a felony, to take the children away from their parent during their lawful parenting time and then leave. And then she complains that he followed her and complained about that. That's simply not this innocent behavior they try to paint on her. And my client... There's a lot of complaints here if he should have made a different choice. There's a different option that's available, and he didn't pick that one, so we're mad at him. You're not punished just because you don't pick the best option or the one that the court might prefer. You're allowed to pick your choices and then deal with them. And I think it's a misstatement of fact to say that he just went and did this. First of all, we all agree that he called the police and they didn't do anything. It's a civil matter. We're not going to get involved. Unfortunately, I hear that a lot from law enforcement. I think that's why there's some attempts to change the statute. There was reaching out to counsel, because if you go through the transcript and look at it, yes, counsel talked about this. It was when the prior client, Ms. Holler from my office, said, hey, my client's going to show up on his Tuesday to exercise his parenting time. It's a small amount of parenting time, and we need to get him started because he hasn't seen the kids in months. Within 14 days, she runs out and files this HRO. For months, she didn't have any issue, and she didn't file for an HRO. But the second that my client and his attorney did what Mr. Brown said they should have done, reached out to counsel to talk about it, then that's suddenly when she goes and gets an HRO. This is the act of desperation. He has excluded the other options. Perhaps he could have tried to go to the court to do something, but legally it's not a criminal contempt because I can't get prior penalty. It's not a civil contempt because I'm not seeking enforcement of something to do. It's not like you could still pay the money. I can't go back in time and give the parenting time back.
But we can't reweigh what the judge decided in terms of motivation. I mean, that's outside our... So how do we grant you the relief that you're seeking without violating our proper role as appellate judges?
The court can, because it can review the legal determinations. Saying, I find he engaged in harassment is not a finding of fact. It is a conclusion of law. It is an application of the facts that were found to the legal framework to say this constitutes harassment under our statute. The findings of fact that this court can't change, even though I might like them to, is that... He went there, he said nasty things, he embarrassed her in front of other people, his words were inappropriate, he followed her, he looked in her car, which that's what the Peterson case says, is you can look in the car and just say, well, this is repeated. You can look in the car to gather evidence of a crime, and if he's videotaping her putting the kids in the back of the car in violation of the court order, he's taking evidence of a crime. That's not an invasion of her privacy. Applying those things to the statute, it does not reach the definition of harassment under the Door case, under the Beach case, and that's where this court has the ability to come in and say, that's not enough. As Beach said, this is inappropriate behavior, it's argumentative behavior, it's offensive behavior, but it's not true threat, it's not fighting words, and it's not an invasion of privacy because she's someplace where my client was allowed to be that she doesn't have a privacy interest in, and I apologize, I'm out of time.
Any other questions from the panel?
No, thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate the briefing and the argument today. The matter is now submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you so much.